Title of my talk is Holding On, Letting Go. And I first topic, looking at holding, as in holding the container during Zazen, or holding someone's distress by our own caring presence, holding our own emotional distress and staying with it, being patient and compassionate, sitting still and finding a way forward. This is a valuable fruit of practice. We say that we keep the precepts, and I hear that we are holding on to them, holding them up to shed light on our own karmic obstacles and allowing them to guide us in our daily lives. We hold on to integrity, to our highest aspirations, to the path as we walk it. And here we glimpse a trap of attachment. A lot of people experience confusion around terms like desire, attachment, commitment, love, vow, and so forth. Holding on can easily devolve into dogma, fundamentalism, ego attachment, and concretizing the self. It's all too easy to hold on too tightly to a sense of self, to our own ideas and views of the world, to our own goals and plans. This becomes clinging and is what the second noble truth refers to as it identifies the cause of suffering. I find this easy to see when I look at greed. This ancient karmic pattern keeps wanting more, keeps being less satisfied with what is. When what is held onto is money or possessions, then dissatisfaction is an inevitable result. And so here's where we start to pay attention to letting go. Letting go has to do with openness, curiosity, equanimity, and non-attachment. It allows us to open our hands and to be open to what comes our way. It allows for new ideas, for change, for growth. And as such, it provides an essential balance to holding on too tightly. And of course, letting go has its own traps of disconnection, indifference, giving up, not caring, passivity, complacence. These are what we might call the near enemies of letting go. That is, they look and feel similar, but are actually different.
Ooh.
As I've talked with people about this in the last several weeks, the question I get is how to do both holding on and letting go skillfully. And I see these two as complementary, that is, working together, each depending on the other, much like wisdom and compassion, meditation and ethical conduct, and other terms we sometimes refer to as two wings allowing us to fly. What to hold on to? What to let go of? I did a Google search for letting go, and it proposed a list of ways to further clarify the phrase by saying what to let go of. Here are those suggestions. Letting go of what once was. Letting go of the past. Of resentment. Control. Anger. Guilt. Perfection. Shame. And I would add, judgment and comparing mind to this list. I found this quote from Zen teaching in Challenging Times. And this is a series of articles by women priests. And Carolyn Joshi Atkinson writes a chapter on accepting our lives in difficult times. She says, the question for me is not so much what I need to accept, but what do I need to give up in order to approach a quiet mind? And then she has a list of things to accept. And I've got a few things that I'll read here from this. Number three is, we might need to accept that often we don't know a lot. We don't know what's going to happen or what is happening or what did happen. Simply put, often we don't know what's really going on. So I would say, letting go of knowing, okay, allowing ourselves not to know. Number four, I'll just read the first two sentences. We might need to accept that being the injured party in a situation does not actually confer any special privileges upon us. Being injured doesn't automatically make us good. So I would say letting go of being right, and especially as a result of being a victim. Number five, I'll just read the first sentence. We might need to accept that we cannot do everything we think we should or be everything we want in our lives. The second sentence starts, we might need to accept that actually we are ordinary. So letting go of trying to do everything, of fixing everything. And number six is, as long as we're really looking at the nature of life, there's this very big challenge. We might need to accept several other demanding teachings from the Buddha. We learn that no matter how much we love or want or fear, we cannot hold on to anything. Everything and everyone we treasure will eventually leave us. The Buddha reminded us all birth ends in death. There are no exceptions for anything that is alive. This means that everything we gather together, our best efforts to preserve what we value, all of this will eventually drift apart, no matter what we may want. Just think how this would change our minds and our lives if we were really to accept all of this. So this refers to holding on as clinging or attachment, as we've seen, one of the traps of holding on. Her article is about acceptance. And acceptance is one of the paramitas or perfections. This one is often translated as patience or tolerance or endurance. And it seems clear to me that letting go is an essential aspect of, or maybe a prerequisite for, acceptance. Lama Suryadas has written a book called Letting Go of the Person You Used to Be, Lessons on Change, Loss, and Spiritual Transformation. And I downloaded this to my Kindle because I came across it yesterday and I wasn't going to be able to wait for Amazon to send it to me in any other form. So here it is. I want to read just a little tiny bit of the introduction. Buddha taught that without any difficulties and problems, we cannot really grow in inner strength, patient forbearance, emotional maturity, and vision. Everything changes. Yet what is most true and real always remains. This has been brought home to me in recent years. I have learned that if you really want to grow as a person and learn, you should realize that the universe has enrolled you in the graduate program of life called loss, according to Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. There's a story about a seeker who travels to the Himalayas looking for an enlightened Buddha in order to receive personal teachings. This seeker wants the last word on the subject of enlightenment. Good luck with that. Walking and trekking for days, he begins to drop his heavy gear as he makes his way to the top of a high peak in Nepal. He drops his tent, his camping equipment, and his heavy backpack. Stripped of almost everything and having breathed so many hundreds of thousands of breaths, he has finally forgotten about his worldly preoccupations. He is very ready to arrive and very ready to listen. He pulls himself up over the final rim of the mountain and looks into the mouth of a cave. Amazingly enough, the Buddha-like master is sitting right there. Stunned, relieved, and overjoyed, the seeker asks the sage, "What is the first principle? What is your most important truth and teaching?" The seeker thinks this is going to be his big moment and that he is about to become enlightened. He's going to discover the one essential thing for him to ponder. And then the Buddha replies, "Dukkha. Life is suffering. Life is fraught. Life is difficult." And the seeker is totally disappointed. He looks around wildly and shouts, "Is there anyone else up here that I can talk to?" Lama Suryadas continues, "I love that story. What do we do when we experience something that isn't quite what we had hoped for? or worse, when we experience something that is truly difficult. Fortunately, within the Buddhist canon, there are many wonderful teachings that provide guidance for us. The teachings help us deal intelligently with loss, change, and fear. They help us with the big questions like the meaning of life and the keys to happiness, and they teach us about death and suffering and how to use everything as grist for the mill and as the means for transformation. So given impermanence, loss, fear, what do you hold on to? What do you let go of? Let's look at vow. When I was postulant, which is a time of training and discernment before ordaining as a priest, someone asked me, curious, do you really think you want to do this for the rest of your life? An interesting question. My answer was, and is, yes, I think so. Of course, I can't make guarantees about the future. No one can. But to the best of my knowledge at this moment, it's one of the highest truths I know. I hold the vow lightly with open palms, allowing it to be whatever it must be. As I age and things change, what it specifically looks like changes. I have to let go of ideas that I can do it all, stay on the schedule completely, take care of all tasks all the time, and so forth. I have to continually reevaluate what this body is capable of. I have to recognize that holding on to this vow is not rigid, that it is in my bones and somehow will manifest as it needs to over time. And it does, continues to do this. Regardless of what happens, I am a priest, and I can trust that even as I let go of fixed ideas of what that means in any given situation. What about love? My late beloved, dead these 24 years, never wavered in her love for me. In a poem I wrote after she died, I referred to her warm regard and how I could trust that. She saw me completely and liked what she saw. This allowed me to see myself more clearly and to like, even to love myself. It also allowed me to love her more clearly. To know that love is not based on a rigid idea of perfection, of always following rules imposed by others, but by allowing for the flow of change, of impermanence. Because everything changes, and learning what to hold on to and what to let go of in the course of change is the key to living life freely. And at some point, recognizing that we are all fundamentally the same in our differences, and that love can be unconditional. This will soften many rough edges. Here's an example that came up this week at the county jail, which I visit weekly. We always begin with check-in. The instructions are to share something of what we are practicing with. One fellow said he was practicing with trying to let go of his desire for freedom. After we sat Zazen for 35 minutes together, I brought that up to discuss and suggested that a desire for freedom was actually a wholesome thing. Where we get stuck is having some idea about what freedom is, what it looks like, what it has to be. There are people who have found freedom and peace in prison. Another person pointed out that when you get free from addiction, there is a sense of freedom. Not deprivation. And these are examples of some of the ways that we get trapped. How to hold on to a love and commitment to freedom, and at the same time, let go of the idea that it has to look a certain way. In this way, holding on and letting go work together. And we have to keep working to discern clearly how both of them operate in each situation. So now let's look at Zazen. We sometimes say that we let go of thoughts in Zazen, and we acknowledge that this is difficult. The mind keeps pumping out thoughts over and over again. What we can do is to simply observe these, not engage with them, and let them go. This requires trust that the thoughts aren't nearly as important as they think they are. That is, we come around to not believing everything that we think. We notice after a while that the mind is always making up stories, and that these are not always based on current reality. Stepping back and watching the flow of thoughts teaches us that thoughts don't always need to be listened to and engaged with. Eventually, we begin to see that the mind doesn't really know anything, and we begin to trust that, to recognize that not knowing is not quite as scary as we thought it would be. And in fact, that it allows for a more open way to look at the world, potential to see things more clearly. Staying present in right now and appreciating what is right in front of us. So right now, pause and pay attention to what you see. And what do you hear? And what about touch? Maybe the feeling of the cushion or chair under you. Other things? Taste? Smell? This is mindfulness, being aware of what's true in this moment. Being aware of your own ability to stay present rather than letting the mind carry you off to stories about the past or dreams of the future. Staying here. As I was typing this, I suddenly had a sneezing attack. I had to stop, blow my nose, drink water, and just attend to it for a few minutes to allow it to clear. The body can help us to stay present if we pay attention to it. As we sit in this hall for a while, we find that the light shifts over time. Sunlight and shadows move. Light dims and brightens with clouds or lack of them. Staying with not knowing allows us to bring new eyes to each situation. Here's something from Dogen's Ehe Kuroku in the section of Dharma words. A footnote says that Rionen was a nun disciple of Dogen's. This Dharma word, along with three others, all with her name in them, were apparently written for her. And I'm just reading one paragraph of it. Wayfarer Rionen, you have the seeds of prajna from early on in life, intently aspiring to the great way of Buddha ancestors. You are a woman and have strong, robust aspiration. Without begrudging any effort in nurturing the way, for you I will demonstrate the precise meaning of coming from the West. That is, if you do not hold on to a single phrase, or half a verse, a bit of talk, or a small expression. In this lump of red flesh, you will have some accord with the clear, cool ground. If you hold on to a single word or half a phrase of the Buddha's ancestors' sayings, or of the koans from the ancestral gates, they will become dangerous poisons. If you want to understand this mountain monk's activity, do not remember these comments. Truly avoid being caught up in thinking. Yogin Sensaki is reported to have said after his Dharma talks, "Now forget everything I just said." I agree with that, but I'd like you to remember long enough to ask questions or make comments at least. So that's what I've got for today. Paraphernalia.
The trouble we are having today is the mouse keeps locking up.
We're not hearing you.
Can you hear us on Zoom?
Yes.
Okay.
So I cannot change the sound settings. Oh, so
gotcha.
Yeah, we will just go with what we have. Gotcha. So if you are in the hall, please raise your hand and I will come to you and say your name and put the microphone up to your mouth. Hopefully, if you are in the Zoom room, you are able to type into the chat that your question or that you would like to speak, and you will be unmuted. And Kate will call on you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you call? Thank you for your talk. This is Sarah. I'm really glad that you shared that relationship you had with your partner and that it was unconditional love. It's really sweet. And I have felt that with my own mother, with my children, with my grandchildren. I am trying to feel that for myself. I think that's one of the hardest ones. I think somewhere in one of our chants or one of our readings, the Buddha says to love yourself, right? Have compassion for yourself. And that's been so helpful when I am triggered, when something happens, when anger comes up or despair or, you know, those emotions. I'm like, well, what's really going on here in this moment? In this moment, I can just take a pause and love myself and work through it.
Right.
So knowing that somebody did that with me and I can do that with my kids, my grandkids, is really, you know, such a lovely gift. And to remind yourself to be present in this moment with whatever is going on. Mm-hmm. And having not knowing mind is very helpful. Sometimes as a senior citizen, you have that without even trying. I just really love that you share that. I never get tired of hearing about someone's sweet relationships. Mm-hmm. And the last thing is, when Lama Sirya Das came to speak, I think we had the Zendo together down on Madison, and he has a really strong New York accent, and I couldn't understand him. He said, "We're going to take a sacred pause." And I was like, what? Over and over he said it, and I was like, what is he saying? And it just really threw me. And so whenever I hear his name, I think of that, and I just think, that was so interesting. It was so different from any other teacher that we shared in the Zendo. And, I just thought he was kind of a magical person. So thank you for bringing him into the talk too.
I think that, learning to love ourselves unconditionally is one of the difficult things. We're not, I would say culturally, that's not a big value. And actually, we're not really taught how to do that. I really do feel that when I started to be able to do that was because of that relationship with my partner. And then I also experienced that from Kyogen, which kind of completed the work. And when you really can feel that, then it makes it easier to feel that for other people in a genuine way, as opposed to kind of a needy way. So it's a work in process, really is.
Thank you. I felt that from Kyogen too. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your talk. This is Mikio. And I'm glad you talked about what exactly did you say, but something about the words, I'm not really trusting much.
Right.
And I just realized I have been doing it in my life. It's anything that something's really important, then I wouldn't use a word for that. It felt like the using the words would kind of twist and change the shape of it. And so now I feel like, okay, maybe I should study this a little bit more. So I know what I'm doing, and I'm sure there's some kind of a, what's the word? It's like, it may not be always good. So thank you for that.
Yeah, words are tricky. And, including all of these, it's like, I sometimes get, my favorite topics are the ones that are almost impossible to talk about. So I throw a bunch of words at it and hope that something makes sense. But, you know, I think about Katagiri Roshi's two books. He's probably written more than that, but the two titles that I really love are Returning to Silence. And then the second one is, But You Have to Say Something. Right?
Right.
I mean, how do we communicate with each other? How do we kind of even make sense of things for ourselves? And but if we recognize that, yes, indeed, that's fine, but it's narrowing what it is. It's like it's making it less somehow. So holding it lightly. That's the only thing I can think of for that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
There's a question from Tony. Okay, I'll read it. You said that the mind doesn't really know anything, but what about insight? It comes in the form of thoughts and seems to have real authority.
Yeah, it does. Well, I think when I said that, the word the mind is actually a tricky word. It's like, what is it that knows? And what is it that doesn't know? I think I'm talking there about the kinds of stories the mind tells us, and that a lot of those are based on something that happened in the past or something we think about that happened in the past, some fear or trauma or something from the past that may or may not have anything to do with what's really going on right now. So it helps me anyway to think, because I think the mind knows everything, right? And it helps me a lot to think, the mind doesn't know anything. Well, that's probably an overstatement of the case, right? But how we think of things or how we perceive things, I think we have to recognize is limited. And how we react to things is usually based on something in the past. And so for me, it really helps a lot to see it as stories. The mind is telling me stories. And it's good for me to at least question, I wonder if this is true, because lots of times it's not, if I really look at it carefully. So yeah, I might have gotten overstated a little bit, but I think, you know, basically it's a good thing to kind of keep in mind.
This is Kiyoshi. I'm hiding behind here.
Yeah, I see. I don't see.
Right.
That's okay.
My question is loving yourself something different from accepting yourself?
Well, I think love includes acceptance, and it includes accepting ourselves exactly as we are, just as we do and need to do with other people. Accepting people as they are, accepting the situations as they are. I think that's all part of the same thing.
Okay, so there's nothing additional with loving over accepting?
Well, I don't know that I'd go that far.
Okay, I guess what I'm reaching for is I'm very familiar with the process of accepting what's coming up. I don't know that I know a feeling of love for myself.
Do you have that feeling for other people? Or like Yogan used to talk about for loving kindness. He used to say, think of something that's really easy to love, like a kitten or a puppy or a baby or, you know, something that makes you go, aw. And to use that as a way of thinking about what if you directed that towards yourself.
Okay. I don't have an immediate response. thank you.
Hi, this is Andy. Wonderful talk. Thank you. I want to piggyback on that. And the thought that just entered my mind, whatever that is, was that the word love itself is a word.
Yes.
And so what Gyoshi is searching for in the word love could be what different from what I think of love is or what somebody else thinks of love is. So one of the traps is that we try to define love. And it's like, I'm looking for this thing called love that has a definition and it's in a dictionary and it might be totally a different thing for me. And so we get wound. So can you say something about that?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, that's part of what we're talking about with this business with words. The thought I just had was, it may be that the things that we need to hold on to are things that words are inadequate to or for. And love is definitely one of those things. You know, our sense of self-worth, our path, as it were. There's a lot of things like that that we have words for, but ultimately are not so easy to define. And definition, by definition, is a limiting. It's saying it's this, but not that. It's providing guardrails around a concept. And the things that we're talking about here are bigger than that.
Thank you.
Since it's right there, let's just take it.
Can you say something about the relationship between holding on and the amount of time we spend remembering the ancestors and the elders? Because that feels like a lot of holding on.
Ah. So you're talking about reverence and devotion. And studying the past and other people's writings and all of those kinds of things. What is it that we're looking for there? I think of all of that as gratitude. And especially the ancestors, I have, you know, it's really funny. The very first time I ever sat for morning service here, my favorite part of the service was the lineage, which didn't make any sense. I had no idea what it was about. I liked the rhythm of it. I liked the sound of it. I liked something about it really spoke to me. And that is still true. And as I have learned more and more about the lives of these folks, I find that they do come alive for me and that they teach me. They still teach me. Every once in a while, I can feel myself being a part of them. I had this really interesting kind of experience once where I could see myself in some old wooden zendo somewhere in the dim, distant past. It was like nighttime, and it was like candlelight, and there were a lot of monks around me, all of us doing kinhin. And it felt comfortable and comforting. So I think we do that to create a connection to the past in the present.
Thank you.
Hey, this is Charlie. I didn't know that that this Charlie was going to be here. So when he sat next to me, like, I could feel my heart just like glow, like so much love. And for Gyoshi's like comment, I feel like it's like acceptance would be more of like a mental thing that is like really important in the mind, acceptance. And like that version of that from the heart's perspective, you know, is much more of like a sensation. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of thought it'd be sort of overwhelming, like, because I haven't been here in like half a year. And it definitely was. In terms of like, like love is super overwhelming, like probably like one of the most overwhelming sensations. And to feel that for someone else has the qualities of like acceptance, because I really didn't even like get a good glimpse of Charlie, but I just like could tell that, oh, he's next to me. And so not even like really an image,
right.
And yet still that like feeling of love.
We experience that a lot of times on Sesshin. You know, I've been to Sesshin at a place where I didn't know anybody. And pretty soon it was like, oh, this person over here. And I'd sometimes give them names, but even if I didn't know them, you know, or I'd say, oh, there's the redhead, or you know, whatever it is, you know. And I remember calling somebody once Wally. I don't know where that came from. It didn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter. But just there's a sense when we sit together, especially over a long period of time, where we start really feeling each other and getting a sense of who these people are. And even though during Sesshin, we're not even supposed to make eye contact or look at each other's faces, right? But you kind of get a sense of who these people are. And there is that. There is. This is why. This is one of those ways that the word isn't really adequate. But it's what we got. In terms of acceptance, I think acceptance is a word that we use, patience, all those words, for something that's hard. And love can be overwhelming, but we don't usually think of it as being hard. We usually welcome it. Acceptance, we sort of struggle with a bit. At least that's been my experience. It's kind of like one of my very first questions that was my own koan was, how do you accept the unacceptable? Because there's plenty of those things in our lives, right? That we just look at and say, And how do you find a way to simply accept it, regardless of what you think about it or what you feel about it? I think it's a part of love eventually. I mean, I think at some point, if you don't have acceptance, it's going to be difficult to find love. But again, those are words.
Yeah, there's a definition of love I like as a deep welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning, Ginkgo. Thanks for your talk. This is Eric. What I'm struck by is when we talk about holding and letting go, it makes it sound like it's a volitional act. It makes it sound like it's something we plan or decide. And I'm aware that a lot of times I don't see any choice involved in this process. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of choices that I've made to be attached to so many things. I seem to have come that way, or they seem to have come long before I was aware I was making choices and forming attachments. But the one that's come to me more recently through my practice is sometimes things fall away. It's not that I've made a decision to be done with an issue. Slowly over time, I realize I'm no longer obsessing about something. I realize I don't have an obstacle in front of me any longer. Mm-hmm. It has fallen away. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware that I've actually made that decision, or I'm not even necessarily aware sometimes of what the process is that has allowed me to experience something falling away. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. That's definitely true. Thank you for bringing that up. It isn't always a matter of us deciding. It's more letting go, I think, of in particular, is a matter of allowing something to happen, being open to that. My favorite example, and my own personal example, has to do with just the decision, the choice to ordain. You know, this looks like it should be something that I would have to think about and be clear about and all of that. And what actually happened was, at some point, I realized I had to. And then I started arguing. And like, what? Wait a minute. This is crazy. You know how old I am? You know how much stuff I'm doing right now? You know how inadequate I'm going to be at this? I mean, I had a list. And ultimately, I had to simply let go and say, oh, okay, I guess we're doing this. Okay, fine. I mean, it was sort of like, you know, sometimes you come into these things kind of kicking and screaming. But they're the choice, if you want to say what the choice is, am I going to do this and live, or am I not going to do this and kill something in myself? So that's the only choice that comes down to. And we're doing this all the time. We have all these things, like you say, we kind of come this way with lots of things we're attached to, things we're trying to hang on to, and things that we're like trying to push away. And that's all there. So the best thing to do is simply to say, okay, but here I am right here, right now, what's going on right now? And see whether I can let go of any other ideas about it, any expectations about it. And I'm not sure I could say that was completely a decision, but there's something in you that has to agree or allow these other things to happen. But something is coming in, maybe. Maybe it's already there. I'm not sure where it comes from. But either way, we have to say yes.
Can you expand a little bit on the falling away?
that's the same thing. I mean, we have to allow it, things to fall away. I mean, things like, I know that this is true. Well, what was it? Oh, I saw somebody go through this. It's like, well, you know, I'm 90%. Well, maybe it's 80. Well, actually, maybe 60%. I mean, you know, like maybe it's sort of not true at all. You know, I mean, there is a process that happens when you turn the light onto it and say, oh, wait, is that even true? And I think for me anyway, that's kind of the way I've experienced it. It's kind of like I look at it and I say, oh, yeah. Well, maybe not. Right. But it's allowing. I like the word allow. That's my latest word, is allowing, allowing things to happen and to be as they are. It's acceptance, I suppose. Ah. The other member of the Charlie cohort.
Oh, here it is. Yeah. I also had that same experience, which is funny because the Charlies, we don't really, when it comes to know each other that well.
Right.
But there's this something about it where it's just like, I feel that same level of love, right? And it's like, oh, maybe it's us grasping at loving for ourselves. I don't know. But my question for you, I can't remember exactly what you said, but okay. It was something to the effect of, what is real and true will kind of stick and the other stuff will fall away. I don't remember what exactly the quote was, though.
That sounds vaguely familiar, but I don't remember exactly either.
I
have it written down in here somewhere. I could, but yeah. And I remember noticing that when I read it this time. But then how do you know what's real and true? I think it probably does have a little bit to do with what is it that sticks? What is it that carries you through difficult times? And paying attention to that. If you pay attention to it and say, I wonder if that's true, and it kind of still sits there glowing at you, the chances are reasonably good, maybe, that it is true, but it's still a maybe in a lot of ways. And you have to kind of test it out by, you know, what if I do this and what if that happens? Yeah.
One of the things I've personally been trying to work on a little bit is like trusting my own inner knowing, right? And realizing that that might be different from someone else's.
Yes.
It doesn't make either person right or wrong,
right?
But like coming into my own knowing and understanding and accepting that for myself. Is that a little bit the same?
Yeah. And I think after a while, we start to recognize, I guess, the difference between that inner knowing and that sort of mental or intellectual idea of, oh, yeah, this is true, as opposed to, oh, this is true. So like knowing that I had to ordain was like, that didn't make a lot of logical sense to me at all. And yet it became clear over time, this is true. This is what I have to do. And there's a feeling, it feels a little different, but I think it takes some time and experimentation maybe to get to know what that might be, to know what to trust and what not to.
Thank you.
We have the third Charlie over here. We must have the third Charlie.
I have to say, this is Charlie. No, it's true. Sometimes you're just there. But funnily enough, I did actually have a question comment thing. I honestly do love it when the other two Charlies happen to be here. Just it's true. We don't really know each other. We don't hang out or have you know, special Charlie meetings. But
I was just gonna say meetings.
Yeah, no. And we haven't been formally recognized as a cohort yet. There is a lovely familiarity about that, even though, like I said, we don't know each other. And this actually works exactly into what I was going to comment on or ask about. And that's the what you said at the very end, which is, okay, this is everything, you know, now forget it all, which I first encountered in the first text I ever read on Zen was actually Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Mm-hmm. And that text kind of set me up for this, oh, you're supposed to, you know, do Zen by essentially forgetting what you just learned and kind of letting it go. But there's a residualness to this.
Yes.
You know, I'm part of the Jisha cohort. I rely entirely now on my body and my cues, basically, to work in a pretty good synergy to do all the motions, to do them right. I wouldn't say that I'm remembering them as such.
Right.
They're in the body.
Right.
So when you talk about words and the inefficiency of words, mm-hmm. and that probably circles really close to the edge of my practice of where I am now. And I think it's actually where all of us are. Definitely the other Charlies, I'm pretty sure. In able to actually verbalize it. Instead you have to like feel it. So I was hoping you could speak a little bit about how that body mind memory mm-hmm. and letting go of the words that have to go with that. How does that come about?
So particularly those of us who are involved in keeping forms in the Zendo, which in many ways is all of us, because all of us are, I mean, it fundamentally comes down to what we do in Zazen. We're paying attention to the body. And so the mindfulness exercise that I did, a little exercise there, had to do with being connected with the body and the body, letting the body inform the mind. Okay. They do work together. And when you first learn the forms, you have to have words, I guess. Mm-hmm. Although technically, I think you're supposed to learn it by watching.
Right.
And paying attention to what's being done and then doing that. But at some point, it starts getting to be part of your body memory.
Right.
As when you're doing these various things, I don't have to think about it now when it's time to go up to the altar and make an incense offering. Mm-hmm. I sort of just know. And, you know, we do the bells partly as a way of saying, not using words,
yeah.
and allowing the body to respond to the sensory cues.
Right.
So that is a part of our practice, and there's ways to do that. Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind is a wonderful text. It's mm-hmm. a wonderful book, mm-hmm. partly because you can go through it and read it, and it's like, wow, that's pretty cool. And then you can start over again, and it's a different book.
Yeah. Yeah. That's happened a couple of times so far.
And it's really lovely that way, because there's somehow, there's some really good stuff in there that, like you say, it leaves a residue. It's not so much that you memorize it or that you can analyze it or figure it all out. It's not like that.
Yeah, the chants are kind of like that, even though you're saying these things.
All of our chanting is part of a body practice.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's depths to knowing. So, you know, you're talking about how do you know, you really notice something within. There's depths to it, including the body as well as the mind and the heart.
I think, yeah, that's what we feel. It's a body connection. That's what I feel when I encounter two other Charlies.
Okay.
So, yeah. Thank you.
And that's we're at time. So I appreciate everyone, all of the Charlies, and all of the rest of you. Thank you for your practice. Thank you all for your practice. Let's see, I got another thing I got to unattach.